This episode is brought to you by 100 Bogart Street, a co-working building in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Need a professional place to work from? Learn more by visiting 100bogart.com. Hey, this is Hannah, HRN's program manager. It's HRN's 10th anniversary and now our summer fun drive. So show your support for independent, revolutionary, entertaining food radio by becoming a monthly recurring donor. HRN is powered by a passionate community of thoughtful eaters, and we need each and every one of you to show your support so that we can keep bringing you your favorite food podcasts. It takes a village, and every dollar donated, every listener tuning in is essential to our continued success. So set up a donation for $10 every month. You'll show us that you want to be a part of a bright future for HRN. And you'll get one of our brand new limited edition Pizza Pocket t-shirts. So snag your new favorite tea and show us some love, all for the price of about two fancy lattes each month. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate today. And thank you.
Welcome to the Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is Rita Jamet. We'll talk to Rita about food, wine, bubbles, hospitality, women and wine, and more. We'll taste some La Caravelle that Rita was so gracious to bring in for our weekly wine sip. I'm your host, Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for the Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. Born in Saudi Arabia to an Iraqi family, Rita Jamet grew up in Lebanon and Switzerland. She received a degree in economics from the University of Geneva, working with her dad upon graduation. She met her French husband, Andre, with deep ties to hospitality and wine, exposing Rita to a life of restaurants, wine, and champagne. Rita is the co-owner and chief bubble officer of La Caravelle Champagne. And we're going to give you a lot of background on that. Welcome to the Grape Nation, Rita.
Thank you. Great to be here, Sam.
I've been thinking about having you on for a while for a lot of different reasons. Champagne, hospitality, women and wine.
So awesome.
We're finally here. Rita, give our listeners a little context about who you are. And I think a good time to start, I mentioned you had met your husband. Mm-hmm. You have a very colorful background. Saudi Arabia,
A lot of steps.
And then you meet a Frenchman who is steeped in hospitality. So take me from there to the current.
Okay. I should say that I've always studied the French school. So I was French educated. French is my main language. So there is already a little conduit to Andre. When I was living in Switzerland, one of my friends had said to me one day, you know, you should meet my uncle. And I'm thinking, uncle, that sounds a little, you know, older.
Old guy.
Older. And in fact, given the fact that Andre is the 10th of 10 children.
That's why.
His niece, who is daughter of the sister number two, was practically my age. So Andre is just 7 years older than me. So it's perfect.
So what year was this?
This was in 1977.
Okay.
76, rather, yeah.
And things happened quickly with you and
Andre? Things happened rather quickly, okay. Yes. And it was a bit of a long-term relationship, a long distance, rather,
right.
Because I lived in Geneva, he lived in Paris. So we'd meet either in Geneva or in Paris or in Burgundy, which was our middle ground.
Good, fun middle place.
Yes.
So what happens where you decide, because I know you left Geneva. Mm-hmm. You just decided it was enough, I have to be with Andre?
When we got married, a little before getting married, I moved to Paris.
Okay.
And then we got married in Geneva. Then, obviously, we settled in Paris. Only a few months after we settled in Paris, the family sold the Bristol Hotel.
So go backwards and tell people Andre's family background, because that's impressive.
It is quite a beautiful story.
Yeah.
So Andre's father, Hippolyte, founded the Bristol Hotel in 1925. And
considered one of the great hotels
absolutely,
of the world, right?
Biggest palaces in the world, yes. And with his wife, Yvonne, they had 10 children. No twins, I should say.
Okay.
And André being the 10th of these 10 children, the youngest of these 10 children. So André was actually literally born in a room at the Bristol Hotel, room 732.
Okay. Great.
And he grew up in the hotel, and then they lived, after that, they lived a little outside of Paris. But that was beyond his world. He was like in this beautiful bubble.
Right.
And so when they sold the hotel, it was very hard for André because...
How old was he?
André was about 35,
okay.
38, yeah.
Was he working there and everything?
He was working there.
Full
he was working there. And actually, another interesting thing is during his tenure at the Bristol, he lived in New York for 2 or 3 years as a representative of the Bristol here because they had a lot of customers, clients from the U.S.
So the closing of the hotel is the event that creates you guys to move.
It's not a closing. It's a sale.
Sale.
Yeah, yeah. They sold it to actually a wonderful group, a German group, the Oetker Group,
okay.
who then went on to do some beautiful renovations and kept really the spirit of my father-in-law. To this day, when we go
to
Paris, we stay there and they welcome us. They say, this is your home, which is really very touching.
Yeah. A place like
it's
that.
It's good karma,
You want to keep the legacy and the history.
Absolutely.
All right, so you come to New York?
We come to New York.
Was New York the obvious choice? Or not necessarily?
We had come to New York because during our honeymoon. And it's so interesting because I like to listen to my gut, what my gut says to me. And when we landed, it was my first time in the U.S., we land here and run away from JFK to Manhattan. Not the most glamorous ride ever.
Better than Newark, but not good at
all. True. So I said to André, I want to live here. And he's thinking, oh gosh, what is this?
Right.
And I said, this is it. You know, I know. I just love this country. And so that's my love story with America started then. And
so what are the first things, because we'll get to La Caravelle.
Mm-hmm.
What are the first things you're both doing when you get here?
When we get here, we had been promised by quote-unquote friends a project where André could work and invest, and another situation where we would get sponsored for the green card. And we get here with our little luggage for 2 months because we packed everything in France in a warehouse. And we realize after a few days that it ain't happening on both fronts.
Oh, boy.
So we're here. What do we do? What do we do? So we immediately turn to each other. We're not going back. We're here. We're going to make it work. Who do you know? Who do I know? With his long history of hotels, you know, he interned in some of the most beautiful palaces in the world in different cities. So he had connections in that world. And he just called and they, you know, the Tisch family. And the GM of the Lowe's, the Regency Hotel here.
They're still
says,
there.
Says, André, well, great, come here, you'll work, and then we'll sponsor you for the green card. And that's how it started. So we're always very grateful to the Tisch family.
So bring it up to when you, because there's probably a lot in between, but let's get to La Caravelle.
La Caravelle.
La Caravelle was an institution in New York. It preexisted you guys coming in.
It did.
But you... Tell me how you got to it, what year, and we'll talk about that a little.
Yes. So La Caravelle was founded in 1960 by Robert Maison and Fred Decré. So when André got his green card, he started to look for a restaurant to do something, either open a restaurant or just see how we could fit into that world. Because it was kind of the conduit after hotel, the hospitality. So he had as his quote-unquote advisor, Robert Maison, on a friendly basis. He'll present projects to him. And interestingly enough, Robert always says, nah, not this one, nah, not that one. Then one day he says to André, why don't you come for lunch with me at La Caravelle? So they go, they have lunch, and then Robert says, I'm thinking of retiring. Would you want to buy my shares, my half of La Caravelle? So André says, sure, that would be great. So that's how it started in 1984.
So... Right after that lunch, everything went into motion.
Right after that lunch.
You moved into, you know, working at La Caravelle.
That's right.
So that's André. What do you do?
So in the meantime,
are you on the ground at the restaurant? Do you join him or not
no,
right away?
Before that, I should say that since, you know, when you apply for the green card, you can't really travel outside of the country. Or you can travel, but you can't come back in.
Right.
So Andre was kind of stuck here. And in the meantime, I was offered a job at the French embassy here. They had the cultural services here.
Makes sense.
So then I got a diplomatic visa, so at least one of us could
you
go visit
go
the family. Right. So that's what I did. And then after the green card arrived, we started having babies.
Right.
And I would call La Caravelle a baby too.
Right.
So three sons during this process.
Well, so you were juggling a lot.
We were juggling a lot. So at first I didn't work at the restaurant, but
right.
then shortly thereafter, 4 years later, Andre bought his partner, who was then Roger Fessaguet, was the original, the chef at the opening.
What year was that? Early 90s?
This was in 88.
That was in 88. You got there 84, he bought in 88?
Exactly. He bought the second half in 88. So then I started to work, yes, at
it was
the restaurant.
All yours. Let's talk about La Caravelle a little, because even to this day, there was a handful of the best, finest, you know, revered French restaurants, and La Caravelle was always one of them.
Yeah.
Tell me a little about it. You know, what made it different? I know you had some famous clientele, the murals.
We did.
I mean, it was, you know, when you look back, people yearn for that.
They do. And actually, there's another interesting historical tidbit, is that Andre's father's his godfather, so his father's godfather, was instrumental in bringing the restaurant, the Drouin, to operate the pavilion. Remember the French, the world exhibition?
Yes.
The French pavilion was manned by Drouin restaurant in Paris. And it turned out to be, it turned into Le Pavillon.
Ah.
Which then was the genesis of all the major French restaurants of that era.
Right. I remember
La Côte Basque.
Sure.
Le Cygne.
Who was the famous person at?
Henri Soulet.
Right. Henri S-O-U-L-E.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
He was sort of the patriarch
exactly.
of the
and
whole
the two,
movement in a way.
Totally. The two founders of La Caravelle worked at Le Pavillon. And one day they decided to open their own place. And Ambassador Kennedy heard that, and he said, if you open, we'll be there from day one, which is what happened in September 1960.
So this is John Kennedy's dad, Joe
yes,
Kennedy.
Exactly.
The real ambassador. Patriarch of that family.
Totally.
Who was an ambassador.
Right. So picture this as a timing.
Okay.
They open in September 1960, and thinking it's going to be like a little bistro. They didn't set out to do a fine dining establishment. And then day one, the Kennedy family dines there all the time. That's their new dining room. And in November, John is elected to be president of the United States.
That's,
guess what the dad does?
That's the craziest thing that could happen.
Totally crazy. So they're catapulted to like that heights.
Right.
And when the White House needed a chef, they would turn to the owners of La Caravelle and identify
someone. You actually recommended a chef.
It was Robert Mézin and Fred Ducret, yes. René Verdon, who stayed at the White
now,
House.
Now, did JFK come in at times?
Yes, yes.
And Jackie continued
lot.
Probably
she did.
As in, she was
till her
became
very
a
last
famous
days.
New Yorker.
Exactly. Till her
I'm sure
very
that
last
was
days.
A good lunch spot for her. And the other thing is, two interesting things. Some pretty damn good chefs came out of there.
Yes.
And not necessarily your traditional French chefs.
No. Nope.
You change with the times.
We
and
did.
The chefs reflected that.
It was
talk
a,
about a
gutsy
few of the
move.
People. Yeah.
It was a gutsy move at the time because a French restaurant always had a French chef. And we had met Michael Romano while he was staging in Switzerland. And through a common friend of ours, Professor Ahrens at the City Tech, he said, you should meet this young man. He wants to come back to the U.S. and do something. So we actually explored opening a restaurant with Michael Romano. And before the Caravelle situation happened. And then things didn't really find a project that was viable. So they said, okay, we each go our own way, and keep in touch. So when André joined La Caravelle, the then chef, André Moisan, said, you know, I need to go work at a club. I don't want to work evenings anymore. I want to have my weekends and all that. So they need a chef. So Andre says, wait, this young man.
Michael.
He's, you know, yeah, exactly. Michael Romano, very with a European sensibility, et cetera, et cetera. So they hired Michael Romano, and this was like a big, big shock. You know, the French dowager, as they call the restaurant, is hiring a non-French chef and an American one.
Right.
So that was amazing.
And Michael was there how long?
Michael was there for a few years, and actually he had the toughest job of all the chefs, because when Michael arrived, the menu was huge. It was Escoffier time.
Right.
Previous century. And he, little by little, brought it to plating, you know, in the kitchen, and more lighter ingredients, less preparations, etc. So it was a very special time to have Michael
and
with us.
Michael, you helped launch a career where Michael went on to become,
yep,
you know, one of the great chefs in New York.
Absolutely.
Union Square,
yep,
Cafe,
yep, absolutely,
and a few other places. But you also brought in another interesting chef.
Japanese.
If you, right. If you think, yes, bringing an American is, how about this move? Tell us about that.
Exactly. So after, like, I would say two chefs later, because all these years, you know, we have circumstances happen and you change chefs. And we had one of the chefs had left abruptly, and we needed a chef. So Tadashi Ono was working as a saucier. He was making sauces there. And we said, instead of looking outside, let's just look who we have here. And we saw Tadashi, very hardworking, very focused, and very good mentality also. So we said to him, hey, Tadashi, would you like to try for the summer? If it works for you, for the restaurant, more importantly for our guests, then we can make a go of it. And that's what happened.
And
then he became the chef, which was another shock.
How long was he the chef?
He was the chef for a good 8 years.
And that's a long time.
That's a long time.
Any tenure for any place. And I'm sure he changed the menu.
He did.
A bit too.
He did. Because we had something, a very interesting structure of menu at La Caravelle. We had the classics, which we didn't want to touch.
Right.
The handful of dishes that will remain on the menu no matter who the chef is.
Right.
And then the other part is chef's inspiration. So that, you know, for a chef,
you wouldn't alienate your old,
exactly,
clientele,
exactly,
and you were able to, yeah, stay with the times.
It was a tricky thing to do so that you have your image doesn't appear, you know, bipolar or kind of.
Was like, Tadashi the last chef there, or
no? Tadashi left. After that, we had. I'm forgetting. I'm sorry.
All right, don't worry.
And then we had Cyril Renaud, which was,
right,
another very interesting. Very interesting.
Tell me a little about Cyril.
So Cyril was working for David Boulay.
Right.
And he had actually never been an executive chef. So he was a sous chef. And then we offered him, you know, the position, which was another gutsy move because he was 29 years old. If you can imagine.
And a kitchen's a crazy place. So anything could happen. Yeah.
It is. But Cyril brought with him this amazing burst of creativity. Like, you'd go to him at the beginning of the meal and you'd say, chef, today, what are you cooking? I don't know yet. As he was,
wow,
composing the dish.
Wow.
Well, the
very
dining room people were like,
creative and spontaneous.
Yeah, right. How do we mark the table? We don't know. But it was very interesting.
That drives people crazy. So you close in 2004.
Yes.
A sad occasion. And there's a few reasons.
Yes.
Why you? I mean, nobody was doing it better than you guys. I mean,
right,
you are, I'm making this word up, a hospitalian. I mean, yeah, hospitality,
totally,
is, you know, your wheelhouse, the food, the creativeness, staying with the times. But at some point, you have to close the doors, and there's a couple reasons why.
Well, before we get into that, I just want to let you know that May 22nd was the actual date that we closed the restaurant in 2004. Yes.
Wait, today?
Today.
Wow.
Is the 15th.
Wow.
Anniversary of the closing of La Caravelle.
That's appropriate.
To
get to talk about it.
I like how you know.
Yeah, that's good karma. Yeah,
it is.
Only good thoughts.
Well, we had problems, big problems after 9/11.
The effect was amazing.
The effect,
right,
was amazing, and we tried to hang on for another 2-3 years, but it was really, really hard.
What was the effect? People were not going out. They weren't spending money.
Exactly.
I mean, were
the
those
notion,
the two primary
the notion
things?
Of luxury and high-end dining had changed. People didn't want formality anymore. You can have fine dining, but more. At the very first stage, it was all comfort food because people needed to be comforted.
Is it fair to say that force the birth of the real casual dining?
I would say it got a big boost, yes.
Now
with
it's big,
some elements of
because millennials have a big, you know, your audience was not, your clients were not millennials.
No.
They were baby boomers and post-war people right. and all of that.
Right.
So 9/11 and what else?
9/11, the rents, I mean, also the high cost of rents. We had high employee costs. And then I think at some point there was a brief, very sad episode, the anti-French movement.
Yeah.
You remember?
Yes.
French fries, Liberty fries and all
yeah.
that. All this put together.
that was Congress and all of that. Yeah. They wouldn't serve it in, you know, the congressional.
But then, you know, NYC and Company did a great effort with the Restaurant Week and special promotions to bring people back into restaurants. Because a lot of restaurants were suffering.
Yeah.
A lot.
I mean, downtown even more because of the proximity physically
yes.
to all that was going
on. It was tragic for a lot of people. But in our particular case, I would say the biggest element was that the fine dining that we were part of, that brand of fine dining was no longer appealing to enough
yeah.
people, the formality of it. And on our end, if we had to change those parts of our DNA, we wouldn't be who we were supposed to be. So
right.
it would be too confusing.
It wouldn't. You yeah. wouldn't be what you
what are
set
you?
Out to. Right.
Exactly.
Right.
So we decided it's better to exit with a big, you know, in a big door in a nice way, in a nice official way. And we were actually nominated for Outstanding Restaurant, James Beard.
The last year. Damn if you do.
Yeah, we were supposed to announce the closing in March. And then we get a call that same night. The night before announcing, we get a call from the James Beard Foundation saying, you've been nominated for Outstanding Restaurant. At first, I thought it was a joke. Then I said, okay, what do we do? We're supposed to announce we're closing. They said, no, whatever you do, hold on till May. So we did. And
wow.
We didn't win,
but we
were nominated.
Now the James Beard Award is, you know,
oh
it's
my
like
gosh.
The Oscars.
Totally.
You know, I'm sure you've been to them. They were recently in Chicago.
I go every year, yes.
All right. Tell me one last thing about La Caravelle. You know, we are a wine show, and we're going to talk a lot about wine and champagne. But in those times, wine, sommeliers, the program were way different than now.
Way different.
How important was the wine and wine program then compared to now? How big was the selection? And, you know, now you walk into a restaurant, there's six sommeliers.
Yes.
Probably in those days, there were six in New York.
Right. That's true.
So
we were one of the first restaurants.
And you were wine guys. So you
we were actually, originally I wasn't a wine person.
But Andre had some
Andre
great
was
exposure
handling,
to
absolutely.
Wine.
He's very knowledgeable
yeah.
about wine, and he's the Chevalier du Tastevin from Burgundy. But he is the first one who, as a French restaurant, featured non-French wines, starting with American wines. He's like, yeah, we live in this country. There are amazing wines in here. And then Italian, and then, you know, from other countries in the world. And that was very gutsy.
So were they embraced? There wasn't much pushback?
Well, we had to do a little, you know, presentation.
Well, you had
and
French
support.
Wines for your people that
exactly.
wanted it. But
we had both options, you know, all options. So
you could say you were one of the earlier restaurants to really open up the list.
Absolutely, because traditionally French restaurants had only French wines, Italian restaurants had only Italian wines, et cetera, et cetera. So we wanted to be global. And we're in New York, first of all. We're in America.
Of course.
Yeah.
You know, they want California. They know Italian.
That's right.
You know the restaurant business. Do you think the wine, as far as the business, was as important then as now? Or it was more secondary? The food was the
I would
star.
Say the food was the primary thing. However, there were not as many wines available as there
right.
are now.
That, so now
that's also
it could,
a big factor.
It showcases better because of
did.
All the options and more of the sommeliers.
Definitely.
So it changed. But you made the move with introducing.
We did, and we did have, we had sommeliers at La Caravelle. Totally. And one of them was a young lady who's now in the South.
Yeah?
So we still keep in touch in Alabama,
nice.
Yes.
Nice. La Caravelle went on to it launched La Caravelle Champagne, which we'll talk about in a minute. Mm-hmm. But in June... June is Women and Wine Month, and we like to recognize, you know, women and wine. We think they're underserved.
That's amazing.
You know, they're right. doing great things and sometimes don't get the recognition. You've been around. As a woman in the business, did you encounter any challenges as a woman, being a woman? Were you pushed to the side? Did you accept? How do you answer that?
I would say in my particular case, I didn't feel much of that.
Okay.
Because I was an owner both of the restaurant and of the champagne brand.
Right.
So honestly speaking, I cannot say that I was, that I felt any discriminations or less of interest or things like that.
So I think part of that is who you are and your personality, what you exude. Nobody's going to screw around. And I think, owning the place and all of that. You see or sense anything around you, or it was hard to even pick up on that?
It was hard to pick up on that, but when we had Susan, who was our somm at La Caravelle, we would give her a lot of, prerogative, so that she didn't have to face those things. And the guests were always asking the male captain, hey, how about the wine? And he said, well, here's our sommelier. Wait, she's the sommelier?
She would go to a table and they would say, send the somm over.
People were very surprised to see her. Young, beautiful woman, and knowledgeable and all that, but they didn't see that at the beginning.
Yeah.
But it took a little bit
of... So there was some of that, not so much with you. Do you think things have changed? I mean, for the better?
I hope so. I think so. That's not to say there aren't any cases out there. You know,
there are more women sommeliers. We know that, right?
Definitely. And not to be, it's a fact that's been scientifically recognized that women have a little better palate. Some women have a more acute
no
palate.
Argument.
Okay, right.
No argument. That's why,
I didn't want to be too pushy.
No. I agree with you. That's why, when you walk into a restaurant and there are somms and there are women, guys, whatever, everyone is, perfectly
absolutely
capable
and
all of that. Tell me a little about something that you're involved in. Le Dame des Coffiers?
Les Dames des Coffiers.
Which plays into this, subject, women and wine.
Exactly.
You're involved for years. What is it?
It's an association of women who are in the hospitality business. And obviously, it includes women in wine. The original chapter, interestingly enough, was in New York.
It was?
And we just opened a chapter in Paris, like this year. It's crazy, but
Why wasn't it called the New York Wine Women?
I don't know.
Fancy schmancy name, right?
Well, we had wonderful founders, Carol Brock, who's still around, and Julia Child was also a grande dame.
Right.
She was one of our, early.
And the goal and motive is to really mentor and elevate
women and support each other, network. Also, we raise money for scholarships for young women who want to study in the industry. We mentor them and we help them as much as we can. We interact with each other, network, support each other, educate each other.
And I would guess today, interest in being a member is more popular than ever.
Absolutely,
right?
Absolutely.
It's a big thing now. That's a good organization, and it's nice that you've been involved. All right. Rita, we're going to take a quick break. We're talking to Rita Jamet. Rita Jamet is the chief bubble officer, which is maybe one of the great C titles in the business of La Caravelle Champagne, which we're going to talk about. You're listening to The Grape Nation. We'll be right back.
This episode was brought to you by 100 Bogart, a new building in Bushwick, Brooklyn, with meeting and event spaces available for on-demand booking. Looking for the next perfect outdoor location for your next gathering? Host your next event at 100 Bogart's impressive rooftop, just steps away from the Morgan L Stop. It's one of the largest and tallest roof spaces in Bushwick, boasting 360-degree views of Brooklyn, Manhattan, and Queens. 100 Bogart's rooftop is available for your next networking event, fundraiser, special performance, or photo shoot. There's approximately 5,000 square feet, ample space for up to 100 guests. For more information on hosting an event at 100 Bogart's rooftop, email info@100bogart.com or call 718-362-3539.
All right, we're back. We're back with my guest, Rita Jamet. Rita, let's talk about champagne in general. We'll get to La Caravelle,
sure.
All right? You're a champagne expert. Tell me in your words why champagne is like no other wine. And you know what I think we should do while you're talking? Give me that little bottle and let's crack it.
Absolutely. Here we go.
Don't worry.
So Sam's about to open our Cuvée Niña. So champagne for me, first of all, it's a magic. It's a magical drink. I am totally biased, and people who are not biased agree with me.
I don't know if you're so biased.
Good.
Well, tell me why you think you're biased.
Because it's my life.
Okay.
Champagne is my life. I think that champagne is, first of all, when you learn about champagne, what it takes to have that beautiful nectar in the bottles
right.
is so much work and expertise and specific climate and terroir and oh,
that's the noise.
There we go.
People forget that it's wine.
It is. It is wine that's fermented twice, but
right.
it's wine. So yeah, if champagne, it has a happy connotation, but it should just be, you know, enjoyed as wine, not necessarily only for celebrations.
Well, that's sort of the problem. It's been known as a celebratory drink.
Yes.
But for the things that you said, because it's a wine and it's so well crafted, it has acidity, the bubbles. It's so great with food.
It's very food friendly. Very, very
Why?
Food friendly. Because let's say you have two ways to match wine with pear wine. It's either by harmony or by contrast. And champagne does both.
Let's Explain
say
that.
Having, let's
so
say
in harmony or contrast?
Harmony.
So harmony would be complementing?
Harmony would be, yes, the same level of acidity, strength, sweetness. Let's say you're having, as traditionally pairing, was the shellfish. Because our elders lived in Champagne and they didn't taste anything else. Then that was they had the white meats only at the max. And that's
oysters.
It. Exactly.
Shrimp.
I mean, champagne with oysters, with sashimi, with raw fish, with cooked
Those
fish.
Those are the classic pairings.
Exactly. And on the other hand, with the advent of global cuisine and kind of being exposed to different flavors, textures from all over the world, even in New York, which is like a melting pot by itself. Let's say you try a champagne with a hamburger. It's amazing. And now it'll be the contrast because the acidity, the bubbles, and the chilled temperature of the champagne will act as a counterpart to the fat in the meat and the cheese or the richness of the bread. So it's beautiful.
People won't think that, but it has all the elements.
It
They'll think like a Zinfandel or a Cab or something.
Exactly, which would be heavy with it.
So I believe this, and I know you'll agree with me, and I think you just explained it away. It's probably the most versatile wine.
Hands down.
You don't worry about white or red, rosé.
Hands down, exactly.
You worry, I mean, it's great with popcorn, french fries, a burger.
A pizza.
Yeah, know, yeah.
Potato chips. I mean, amazing.
Yeah, and I think it's always been around, but it's having its time. And not a time that's going to come and go. I think it now has become part of the
sure.
repertoire of wine lists.
It's opened so many possibilities. That's the beauty of it.
So what changes have you seen in champagne? You know, the product, how it's used. I mean, their grower champagne is a big thing. Wine lists now have more. You know, tell me some of the changes that you've noticed, that you've experienced in the business and as a consumer.
You've actually put the finger on this new category, it's always existed, but now it's more at the forefront, the grower champagnes, which is, it's a beautiful addition to the landscape.
Right.
Only some people tend to think that grower champagne is great and the big houses are not, which is totally wrong.
Well, give me your definition or explanation of what grower champagne
is. Grower champagne is a grower who has his own vineyards and makes the champagne, elaborates the champagne himself or herself with the grapes from their own property, their
Brands
own vineyards.
And bottles it under their name.
Exactly.
Now, to your point, answer this question. Where did the big wineries get a lot of their
It's a combination.
Wine?
You have combinations. You have big houses who actually own some vineyards. So they have...
But...
And they also buy,
right.
you know, the grapes from other producers.
Right.
So
some of the growers.
Other growers,
some
exactly.
Some of the growers
it's
decide, I've been... You know, contracting grapes to these guys.
Exactly, because there's not enough. You know, it's a matter of quantity. There's not enough.
Are you, I know you're happy, but are you surprised the depth of some of the champagne-less in restaurants in New York. I mean, they go on for pages, Rita.
Yes. I think it's wonderful because it shows the diversity of the champagne terroir and the wine making. And there's so many different styles. As a consumer, what you want to do is to find the style that you like, that makes you happy. That's the first thing I learned about wine. I was hanging out for a weekend with Clive Coates for a charity event. Right. I said, I'm going to pick his brains. So I said, Clive, what makes this a good wine? And he said, I'll spare you the British accent, but if you're happy to go down your pocket for this much money and it's making you that happy, it's a good wine. So that was the most unintimidating and helpful thought, because what matters is you. It's an enjoyable thing, and you know your style. You drink what satisfies your style. That's it. That's all you need. And having that diversity.
I agree, and that's well put.
Having that diversity in champagne and depth allows you to explore many different styles, and I think it's wonderful.
Do you feel there's still great value in champagne? Because we know there's some of the growers and producers, you know, your dear friend Krug is not a cheap champagne. I mean, we're not at the point where we think champagne has outpriced itself as a beverage. And you're going to answer that, because I think La Caravelle fits in that box. But take that out of the box for a second.
I think you have so many people don't realize how many inherent costs there are into producing a bottle of champagne, and especially if it's aged. That means it's your money is sleeping,
sitting around.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Aging in those beautiful cellars, but that's immobilized money, so it tends to be more costly. I also think that the champagne making is a process that requires more steps, more people, more knowledge. And also, especially if you have a climate, you know, challenges, you need to make that up into your champagne so that it keeps its style for the big houses.
Right.
So for me, as an insider, I think it's completely justified. Completely justified. Yeah. Because it's worth. And I think people need to learn a little more about what it takes. It takes a lot of steps and a lot of resources.
But that being said, there's still some wonderful champagnes at
reasonable
prices.
Some houses don't have big marketing costs or just like yours truly.
Right.
We're lucky that we can have a system. Granted, it's a niche brand. It's not a widely.
Well, let's talk about La Caravelle now. So give me a little history. You launched the brand in the restaurant
because
it made sense. Tell me the moment where you said, we got to throw a label on.
There's another little story about with the genesis of that. Andre's father, his godmother, he was, protected for godmother. His godmother was Madame Voltner, who was the then owner of La Mission Aubryon in Bordeaux.
Nice.
So the winery produced a special barrel just for the Bristol. It was their own proprietary, barrel. So Andre used to go with his dad to La Halle au Vin, the big hall, and take that, and then they would bottle it. It would be the Bristol special. So that kind of planted an idea in his brain, and we both love champagne. And so we thought, hey, how about we try to have a house make a champagne for us, and then that'll be ours just for our guests, not for outside purposes, just for our guests. So that's what happened, and in
what year was that?
98, beginning of 98.
Great idea. A little exposure, with Aubryon and the idea that you could do that. Mm-hmm. So what do you do? Who do you reach out? How do you get that done?
Well, we had a very good friend at the time who was in the champagne business, and the house that produced his champagne, the winery, agreed to make a cuvée for us.
Who was that?
So
can
that
you
was
say?
The it was La Goutte d'Or. The winery La Goutte d'Or.
Okay.
So so we started with that, and then carried us all the way till the closing of the restaurant. We also, in the meantime, we had a line of cognacs, which was beautiful.
Still?
No, it's finished.
Okay, but you have a Bordeaux still?
We have a Bordeaux from
Listrac.
Exactly. Made by a cooperative of Listrac, and a small production. Not every vintage is available because the winemaker only releases what he deems is the best.
So when the restaurant closed, was it obvious?
So we thought
that
we had
you would carry the brand
not
on
at all,
or
not at all.
Not
our,
right away.
Our thinking was we close the restaurant, everything stops.
Okay.
And then our friends and our guests and our family were like, hey, why don't you work with market the champagne? And the Bordeaux, I was like, that's a totally different situation. I'm in the restaurant business. Now I'm going to be in the wine business. It's so different.
Was that scary to you?
It was super scary. The biggest scare for me was, in addition to all the technical steps to make it happen, was to be a salesperson. I do not like to
I knew you were
going to
say that.
I don't like to. I like to promote, which is very different from selling. And
the funny thing is, though, I bet you still feel that. But you're so cut out as a people person in the way you connect. But it's still,
but you
still
know,
get a little pit.
I do. My approach is, at the end of the day, if you don't really want the wine, I'm not going to go twist your arm or force
softer
my way.
Softer sell.
Softer. The product has to speak for itself.
Okay.
And of course, our friendship will open a door or help the connection. But the product itself has to be the one that makes you take that decision.
Well, I guess two things happened. A lot of great connections and contacts from the restaurant.
Yes, yes.
And through the years when you got started, I mean, I don't know if network is the word, but you're really out there. You really know people in the business. I mean, walking into a Somme, somebody you know.
Yes.
Whether they buy it or not, it's one thing, but the connection
exactly,
there.
Exactly, exactly.
You know,
well, you know the,
the
restaurant world and hospitality was my world.
Right.
And then when the Caravelle closed, I was like, I don't want to leave this world. It's too full of wonderful people, and it's my natural instinct to
but
be hospitable.
But you had to sell, though.
I had to sell.
All right, so La Caravelle is a brand that started in the restaurant, mm-hmm. and you currently, or you've had three different bottlings.
Yes.
Let's talk about each.
Sure.
You slot them in any order that you want.
Okay. So if you're going to go by intensity,
do
flavor
that.
Intensity,
first,
yep. So we will start with the Blanc de Blanc. Is 100% Chardonnay, which comes from
That's
the Côte
Blanc
de Blanc.
De Blanc means.
Exactly, because
setting.
Chardonnay is the white grape,
right.
and so Blanc is white. And it's actually a beautiful champagne because it's aged for 3 years. And so it's really, it's got wonderful notes of it's very fresh and it's got beautiful acidity, but not too sharp either.
Okay.
So that's the thing we always wanted to achieve is balance. In the flavors.
Now, we'll talk about the three, but is the production of one more than another?
Or? I would say the Blanc de Blanc is the one that is the least, just because it's a little more, and I'd say esoteric, but less people are familiar with it, you know.
All right, so that's the Blanc de Blanc. 100% Chardonnay.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the La Caravelle Blanc de Blanc.
La Caravelle Blanc de Blanc,
okay.
Yes. Then we have the Cuvée Niña.
Okay.
Cuvée Niña is we call it the Brut, even though all three are in the Brut category. It's a blend of the three most, the largest grape in Champagne is Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, and Pinot Meunier. So Pinot Noir, Pinot Meunier are red grapes.
Right.
And they each bring, an element to the blend. And that's why I always like to start tasting the Blanc de Blanc. Then we go to Cuvée Niña to see what the Pinot Noir and the Pinot Meunier, which will bring a little structure and a little bit of more fruit. And
does the blending vary much? I mean, do you keep the blending similar for a style, or it depends on the vintage and what's available?
I would say yes, yes and no. The base blend is the same. Granted, it might vary a couple of points depending on the year, the climate, if the ripeness.
But
not major. And you do want to maintain the same style unless you're doing it for 1 year, the vintage.
Right.
So then the Cuvée Niña is aged for 2 years. In the bottle.
How'd you come up with Cuvée Niña?
So Caravelle is the type of ship that Christopher Columbus sailed on when he discovered the New World.
Okay.
And his three Caravelle ships were named Niña, Pinta, Santa Maria.
Here's the Niña.
That's it.
Okay.
We thought it was fun instead of calling it the
tradition.
No, I like that.
But it's more fun if people understand
Absolutely.
Where it comes from.
It
so
does take an explanation,
you.
Yeah.
All right, so that's the second wine. Yeah. And then the third one.
The third one is the rosé, which I like to call double magic because not just the bubbles and the happiness.
I think when people think of you and La Caravelle, they think of the rosé too. Not to diss the other
right,
two, but
yeah. So rosé is you can make rosé champagne two methods. There are two methods. One is the blending type, which is what we have. They take the base blend of the Cuvée Niña and they blend in still Pinot Noir wine,
right?
To make the rosé.
Okay.
And it's the only area in the world where you can do that, by the way.
Right.
And then there's the other method is the bleeding method, which is...
Helps with color?
The color. When you leave the red grapes long enough...
Tell me what bleeding
enough,
is.
The skin of the red grapes, Pinot Noir, Pinot Meunier, they will seep, the color of the skin will seep into the wine.
So skin if you leave contact, it long enough. You exactly. leave it in, okay.
Yeah, that's the other method of okay. making, yeah.
So that's the rosé.
Yes.
And then quickly you make a red Bordeaux from the region of Listrac.
Listrac in the Médoc.
Why? I mean, why did you decide?
It just so happened, it came our way. It's not something we were looking for, but it just so happened that one of our friends, who was one of the biggest wine buyers at the time, stumbled upon this cuvée and vineyard. It was actually called Caravelle.
Oh, really?
So we talked and we said, you know what? This is good. It's good. The price was super attractive as
Let's
well.
Let's do it.
Let's do it. Okay. So it's a Merlot, predominantly Merlot based, which is a little rounder. Then it's got also Cabernet Sauvignon nice. And a little Petit Verdot.
Yeah. Nice. So that's La Caravelle Listrac.
Listrac.
If people want to get more information, where's the best place for them to look? Is there a website?
There's
is
our
there
website,
social media?
LaCaravelle.com.
Okay.
Social media, I'm pretty, yeah.
Well, we'll get to that in a minute. Available retail, available
yes.
in a lot of New York restaurants.
Yes.
You know, kudos
about
to you
80,
for getting the product out there.
Thank you.
So if you are out and about in New York and in some other cities and you want a delicious champagne at a great value, you know, look out for La Caravelle. We're big champagne fans on the Grape Nation. Rita, we do a thing called the wine list. We ask our guests five questions. Everyone gets the same five questions. Don't dwell on them.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to give
okay.
long answers. We're running out of time, and
okay.
I want to
get
this in, and I want to talk. You know, let's okay. evaluate the Nina for a minute or two in our wine sip. So let's buzz through these. The problem is I'm throwing a ringer in. It's called the wine list, but this is the special Rita Jamet wine and champagne. So there's potentially Uh-oh. A wine answer and a champagne.
Okay.
All right, so the first question is, what's Rita drinking now? What is she trying? What's the season pushing on her? What's in her fridge? What's got your attention?
In addition to champagne.
Yes. That is,
in addition to champagne. I happen to love López de Heredia, which is a Spanish wine.
Oh, López de Heredia.
López
okay.
de Heredia, yes.
Okay.
Delicious wine.
So Spanish
There's
wine?
Spanish wine. There's a Chablis that I'm very fond of. It's called Moreau Naudet.
Okay.
It's actually, you recognize the label. It's like the OK
Spell
sign.
For me.
Moreau hyphen Naudet.
Oh, Moreau. Is
yeah.
that the...
That's the one that
the
does...
The hand.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
The hand.
I tell this to everyone. I will post your answers because people love to, you
right.
know, kind of follow up on your recommendations. Anything else?
I always love Burgundy. Burgundy
okay.
Volnay.
Okay.
D'Angerville is my...
Yeah.
Like, yeah my
Those good. Are good ones. now, champagne, non-La Caravelle. What do you like?
I love Krug. I love Laurent Perrier Grand Siècle, this beautiful cuvée.
I had lunch with Michelle DeFeo.
Oh, New good.
York, and she introduced a whole bunch of new Grand Six.
They're beautiful,
they?
Aren't
were
they?
Beautiful.
They
there
are
were
beautiful.
Three or four of
yep.
them. It was
beautiful,
nice to taste
beautiful
them.
Beautiful champagne.
And I know you're close to the Krug family. All right, Rita. Rita Jamet's favorite wine and food pairing, and then give me a favorite champagne and food pairing.
Food and wine, meaning which the type of food to start
yeah,
with.
Yeah, what's a great pairing? What
what's
do you like?
You. With champagne or not?
Give me wine first and give me champagne.
Okay.
Not what you think is a good idea, what you like.
Oysters and Chablis.
Okay. So that's your wine.
That's my wine.
We have a rule that you can't say oysters and champagne because it's too good and too obvious.
Good.
So for champagne, besides oysters.
For champagne, I would say sushi or, okay. or burger.
Okay. So you had mentioned burger earlier. We're begging people to try a nice champagne with a burger.
Oh, yes.
Okay. All right. This is a tough question for you, and I don't want you to be exclusive, meaning leaving anyone out of friends. So do your best. We ask people their favorite wine restaurant and or bar that has great attention to wine, champagne, they're knowledgeable, their selection, the environment. Does anything jump off the charts for you? Now, I've been following you for a while, and you have a pattern. You favor certain places. I mean, you know your stuff, but you're at some places more than others.
I would say Le Bernardin, Jean-Georges, for sure.
Flora
Bar.
Great wine.
Flora Bar.
Okay.
Very interesting wine list. Esoteric wines.
Good answer.
Which I love too.
Give me one more.
Union Square Cafe.
Okay. That's Josh Wagner, I think.
Yes. Jason.
Jason Wagner. Right. He does a good job with one. All right. Good answers. All right. Favorite. You got to give me two answers here. And it doesn't have to be just one if it's more than one. But one for champagne, one for wine. Rita's favorite all-time wine and favorite all-time champagne.
Favorite all-time wine is Volnay from Dangerville.
Any particular
Les
vintage?
Les Champagnes. 08.
Okay, but that wine.
Or 15.
That's a favorite anyway.
That's a favorite.
Great answer. And then besides Le Caravelle, give me a champagne, an all-time favorite.
With vintage you want or not
well,
necessarily?
I think there's two answers. I think favorite all-time champagne and is there or was there a vintage that you remember?
I would say in the rosé, I would say Laurent Perrier for their rosé.
They're very well known.
Cuvée Alexandre, yes. That's okay. Beautiful rosé. And then I really like the Krug style very
okay.
much so. Whether it's the Grand Cuvée or it's the Claude Duménil or Claude Ambonnet, they're just...
That's the way you answer that, Rita. All right, last question, and I'm going to make this easy for you. The question is, recommend the best wine around $15-$20. Now, I'm going to push that question off the table, and I'm going to say to you, recommend the best champagne values, and I'll answer it first. Le Caravelle is a champagne that's accessible, that's wonderful, and it's priced right. I don't want to send people to your competitors, but can you think of other good value champagnes? What's good for $30, $40, $50?
Perrier Jouet, probably.
Okay.
Is a good
solid
value. Solid.
Okay.
Tétanger, I'm not sure, but I think they're beautiful champagnes.
They may
I'm not
have
sure about
something.
The prices.
Okay.
Yeah.
But you can get champagnes in that price range.
You can.
All right, Rita. Did a very good job.
Thank you.
And I like the little fear in your face for a moment. That's the whole point of it.
I want to make sure I do a good job
and
represent myself.
We're going to wrap up. Before we wrap up, we do a thing called the Weekly Wine Sip. And it's a chance for us to taste wine on the air every week. And it always makes sense when our guest is involved in it. So let's do the, you want to do the Nina or you want to open that?
We can open. We have the Nina open.
Don't open that. Keep that. No. We'll talk about the Nina or whichever one you want.
Yeah, no, let's do this
okay.
one. I brought it with me.
All right. So we tasted the Cuvée Nina. Let's give me a couple of quick vitals on that. Retail, a bottle of the Cuvée Nina is about?
It's around 35.
So there's an incredible value
yes.
for an incredible champagne, and we're drinking that now. Because Cuvée Nina is a Blanc de Blanc, and we did mention it quickly, but tell people again what would be a great food pairing.
Can you open some?
I'll do it. Rita's trying to open.
Because I had shoulder surgery.
I'll be the expert one.
So, yeah, the Blanc de Blanc can be, you want contrast or you want harmony?
You got both?
I got both, okay. My favorite is with... the Blanc de Blanc, I would say, with caviar and on potato chips.
Okay. That's not separately.
Together or caviar itself.
Right.
Caviar, like, with a mother of pearl spoon.
So Blanc de Blanc, a little tin of caviar,
uh-huh.
and potato
little,
chips is
always,
your delivery vessel,
yes,
right? So
yes.
you put the caviar and then
exactly.
you just,
or you can
salt,
have the caviar as is.
Potato chip, the saltiness,
fat.
The fat.
Yeah.
Okay. And Rita, you know, Rita likes to hang out with the Petrosians. So she's
I do.
she's hooked into caviar. All right. So Rita, we tasted the Nina. We are tasting the Blanc de Blanc.
Blanc
now,
de Blanc.
Right?
Yeah.
Tell me a little about this.
So the Blanc de Blanc, being that it's aged for 3 years, it gives time to that single grape, the Chardonnay, which is delicate grape. It's the one that has the most acidity. But then with the time that it spends in the bottle, the flavors are kind of evolving with a little brioche and
I
a little...
I was just going to say,
yeah,
compared
almond.
To the Nina, you get that classic biscuity,
exactly,
brioche-y,
yeah.
baked
gingerbread
yeasty.
Maybe even a
yeah.
little bit. And
yeah.
then at the end, you'll get that
and
acidity
the nose,
that comes in. Yes.
There's a nice, strong
white
nose
flowers on
yep.
the nose.
Yep.
I like to say yuzu. Mm. It's very
there is
fragrant.
when you think about that citrus or that sweetness,
yeah,
it's not like lemon or Meyer. It's yuzu
kind of
or something.
Citrus with floral a little bit.
All right, tell me. Wait, did we just pair for Blanc de Blanc or Nina? I forgot.
Blanc de Blanc.
Okay. So let's go backwards. On the Nina.
On the Nina, I really like pizza with it a lot.
Okay. The Nina more than the Blanc de Blanc?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And also the Nina and then the rosé with red meats. You can have the rosé with barbecue or even the Nina with barbecue, with a steak, with lamb, burgers.
So our message here is, and we could probably sit, we're going to have to wrap up, but we could probably sit with Rita another hour or two. The message is that champagne is very versatile.
Yes.
We've recommended some foods that people wouldn't think of to pair with it, and that you should think about drinking more champagne.
It goes
instead
without
of going
saying.
To a restaurant with a white and a red.
Right.
Bring a champagne and a red.
Absolutely.
Bring a champagne and a white.
Absolutely.
Can you think of a better way to kick off a meal? Forget the celebratory part.
No.
But the pairing and all of
yeah,
that?
Yeah, champagne should be a just-because drink, not for an occasion.
Okay. And look out for La Caravelle. Rita, we're going to wrap up. I'm going to ask you to give me some information, but hold on for a sec. If you have a question, suggestion, wine happening, or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation.com. Follow us on Facebook at The Grape Nation. Follow us on Instagram at SBenRuby. That's me and the hashtag The Grape Nation. On Twitter, it's at BenRuby and the hashtag The Grape Nation. Also, subscribe to our podcasts, The Grape Nation Podcast. We're on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify. As I said earlier, and I think you'd like to dig into this, we'll post Rita's wine list, and I will list Rita's champagnes and some of the pairings on our social media. You'll see it on Facebook. You'll see it on Instagram. Rita, if we want to follow you and the La Caravelle brand on social.
On social.
We talked, you can go to the website,
sure.
La Caravelle.
Sure,
but
sure.
Where can we find you?
So Instagram, Rita Jamet.
Okay, at Rita Jamet?
At Rita Jamet, R-I-T-A-J-A-M-M-E-T.
Right.
And then at La Caravelle Champagne.
Okay. And you have a terrific hashtag because you eat a lot of champagne and you drink a lot of champagne.
Other than Lucky Rita?
Yes. You could look at Lucky Rita too.
Then it goes to Lucky La Caravelle Champagne too.
Right. And wait, what's the handle Caravelle Champ?
Caravelle Champ is Twitter.
Twitter.
Yeah.
And that's one of your older ones.
I love it because my son came up with that and I love the double meaning.
All right. So before we wrap up, let's talk 30 minutes about your son. You have more than one son, but I want to talk about one particular one. And I wanted to talk anyway, but there was a wonderful story on CBS this morning. Is it Nicholas?
Nicholas.
Nicholas is one of the principals.
He's one of the co-founders of Sweetgreen.
Sweetgreen. Mm-hmm. And Sweetgreen, the concept, just quickly.
Sweetgreen is a fast casual that was founded 11 years ago by three students from Georgetown who were tired of not having healthy and good dining options. So they came up with this. It now has 94 locations.
It's ubiquitous in New York. I was just going into Hudson Yards and there it was.
Oh, yes.
You know, right there. And the story that I saw this morning, and it's more than admirable, is they've devised for their employees that you get 5 months leave.
Yep.
Enough where it's so uncommon that it's a news story.
Yes.
You build loyalty and people through offering things like that. So Rita, besides making good champagne, has some pretty good offspring too. All right, Rita, I want to thank you for being our guest today. Thank you to Rita Jamet.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, it was a pleasure. And
my pleasure.
I will have to have you back because we have to cover a lot of other things.
Just say when.
Rita is the owner of La Caravelle Champagne. She is the chief bubble officer. So thank you for coming in and spending time with us. Thank you to our engineer, Matt, on the board today. And thank you to everyone at the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sam BenRuby, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation.
And thank you, Sam, and to all the listeners.
Cheers,
everyone. Bubbly cheers.
Cheers. Bye.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network.
Food Radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.